Good morning, everyone. The panel has before it a total of five cases. Two of them are being submitted without oral argument on the briefs later today. Those cases are Appeal 3274 from the present year, Estrada versus Merit System Protection Board, and Appeal 7117 from 2008, Barraquis versus Department of Veterans Affairs. On the argument list, we have three cases. Before calling the first case, the court would like to welcome and acknowledge the generous participation of our visitor from the United States District Court for the Southern District of California in San Diego, Judge Marilyn Huff. She sat with a panel yesterday and sitting with this panel today. We're very happy to have her help, and we appreciate her generosity to come here and take on some extra duties. Thank you very much. We'll hear argument first in Appeal 5111 from 2007, McDonnell Douglas versus the United States. Mr. Cooper, good morning. Welcome back to the court. To you, please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Judge and Judge Moore, Judge Huff, and may it please the court. I represent McDonnell Douglas in this appeal, and I'd like to divide the appellant's time with my colleague, Counsel for General Dynamics, Mr. Verrilli. I also would like, Your Honor, with the court's permission, to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Very well.
Thank you, Your Honor. The last time this case was here in McDonnell Douglas 12, this court held that the trial court had misconstrued and misunderstood this court's mandate in McDonnell Douglas 10 concerning the controlling standard that governs default terminations for failure to make sufficient progress. So this court clarified in elaborate detail that the Lisbon standard applies to this case. And the court provided detailed remand instructions on how the trial court was to determine under Lisbon.
Well, how can you apply Lisbon in a case if there's no final performance date?
Your Honor, actually, applying Lisbon in this context is an application in its purest form of the Lisbon test. The government has it in its own power to unilaterally impose a new contract schedule. When it refrained from doing that and just imposed a partial schedule in P-46 for the first 8 prototype planes, it did so quite deliberately, quite consciously, and on the basic agreement
but
with the contract.
Isn't it agreed that there's no final performance date, which would, I guess, be for the last lot of production airplanes?
Your Honor, the trial court found quite correctly.
And it's not disputed by the parties.
It's not disputed at all.
But in Lisbon, there was a final performance date. So the Lisbon opinion necessarily assumed that the analysis would work because there was a final date. In a case like this where everybody agrees there isn't a final date, it seems like you can't do a Lisbon analysis in the normal fashion. You'd have to either not apply Lisbon at all, or you'd have to apply what patent lawyers might call a doctrine of equivalence version of Lisbon.
Your Honor, we would respectfully submit that in fact Lisbon must apply and ought to apply even in the context in which the government has, for one reason or another, either not initially incorporated a contract schedule and a final completion date, or where it has, along the way, for one reason or another, waived that contract schedule without reincorporating
your final completion date. Is that Lisbon, under our mandate, has to be implied in a sort of strict, literal fashion, despite the lack of an end date?
Your Honor, it's our submission that the Lisbon test is very government friendly, and that yes, the burden is on the government if it wants to impose, Your Honor, the draconian sanction of default termination and visit what could be a massive forfeiture, which the court has often said is judicially disfavored and must be narrowly applied and construed. If it wants to do that, the burden we would submit must be on the government to bring forward the conditions that enable it to do that. And, Your Honor, in the absence of a contract completion date, it would simply be unfair to a contractor to then hold it to failure to make progress against a schedule that really just doesn't exist.
What about if the court took the view that in the absence of a firm calendar date, that the assumption should be that the final production lots would have to be produced in a timely way, in some reasonable time frame?
Your Honor, even if that were the court's view, it could not affirm the default termination in this case, because there was never any effort on behalf of the government, the contracting officer, or anyone else to try to establish what a reasonable extrapolated date might have been for contract completion in this case. Admiral Morris never made any effort when he terminated to either to establish a new contract date, completion date unilaterally, or to undertake any kind of analysis in terms of what a reasonable under the circumstances and at the time.
But couldn't the government's position be understood to be essentially that the two companies effectively admitted that for primarily financial reasons they couldn't perform all the steps and deliver all the items under the contract by any date? Not next year, not 5 years from now, not 10 years from now, not by any date.
Your Honor, actually, that argument, to the extent the government is making it, is simply foreclosed by the findings of the court below, which are not clearly erroneous. There was a trial, Your Honor, on whether or not the contractors had provided adequate assurances about their ability and willingness to perform. The court rejected specifically the notion that financial incapacity or unwillingness was an element of the termination. And in fact, Your Honor, the most emphatic evidence supporting the court's clearly correct, we would submit, finding to that effect is that the cure notice itself had no mention of financial capability or willingness to perform. The termination notice made no mention of it. The court emphasized that these contractors were, at the time of termination, spending $120 million at minimum a month in their performance on these contractors.
Well, what about Admiral Morris's testimony that they couldn't meet the specifications, they couldn't meet the time schedule, they couldn't produce the product that they had promised to produce?
Your Honor, those comments also were before the court, and the court placed them in the correct context, in their proper context. Those comments made it at trial were, Your Honor, in connection with the contractor's statements made in reaction to the government's very abrupt insistence at the time of termination on the original specifications, Judge Michel, that had been themselves modified through the agreement and through the critical design review process, and especially the weight specification, which a year before termination had been modified and accepted by the government.
In the contract? In a modification in the contract? Or in a separate process on the side?
Your Honor, in a separate process, but there's not a dispute in terms of whether or not weight was no longer in the case, and yet weight was in the cure notice. The government quite abruptly, as I say, insisted not just on the original specifications, which had been modified through the normal process in a contract, research and development contract like this. This is the norm, but the original schedule was also something they had insisted upon. And when the contractors reacted very negatively to the notion they could be held to that, well, it was hardly a surprise. And the other thing, Your Honor, to keep in mind, and that the trial court credited, were Admiral Morris's specific statements at the time of termination. And as the court held, in the analysis of Admiral Morris's an analysis of Admiral Morris's testimony next to his conduct at the time shows that Admiral Morris was not concerned about the contractor's impairment of timely completion. And with respect to the financial issue, the court specifically held that the evidence at trial established that the contractor's financial ability was not a concern of Admiral Morris. So, Your Honor, there was a trial on this. All of this, the government's favorite statements were put before the judge, and the contractor's favorite statements were put before the judge. He sifted through those, and he concluded, we submit to you quite correctly, that the contractors did provide adequate assurances. And besides, that issue was tried by the government the last time they came before you, exactly the same.
A little unusual for an appellant to be so defensive of the judgment below, or at least the findings.
Well, Your Honor, that's kind of
you like part of what he did, but you don't like the other part of it.
Well, Your Honor, we're in a paradoxical position. The court's findings are fatal to its conclusion under this court's mandate and under Lisbon. If Lisbon does apply, then we must win. And in fact, the court was quite acutely self-conscious of the thin ice that it was on in its reading of this court's mandate, oftentimes saying it may be foreclosed, it could be called into question. And
maybe the mandate was inartfully drafted.
Well, Your Honor, we don't see how the court could have made itself clearer than it did. It's choosing its words carefully.
Well, let me ask you this. Even if it was very clear, and even if with that clarity it was impossible to apply strictly, is the present panel somehow foreclosed from reviewing Judge Hodges' judgment in light of what we could call a revised mandate?
Well, Your Honor, I think this court's precedents are very clear that a trial court has no authority or discretion to vary from the court's mandate. If this court thinks better of the mandate later, perhaps it has the authority, or at least the en banc court would have the authority to vary it. But Your Honor, the
en banc court makes it too easy. That's why I asked the question whether this panel can reinterpret the mandate in effect, finding that any error by Judge Hodges in failing to strictly apply a Lisbon analysis was harmless error because the mandate was inartfully drafted, and in view of what we might, just hypothetically musing, what we might consider a revised mandate, what he did was sufficient. Maybe.
Your Honor, I would submit to you that this panel would not have that authority.
Because
I think that ruling by a different panel, Chief Judge excluded a different panel, is the law of this case.
Well, certainly normally the law of the case, but if it's based on a mistake of fact, maybe it should be subject to revision by a subsequent panel.
Your Honor, our submission to you is that it would not be a subject to revision by this panel. This court would not have the authority to vary the mandate. But even if it did, Your Honor, presumably it would have to have something in the record that would allow it to conclude that there was no reasonable likelihood that the contractors could have performed the contract, the entire contract, within the time remaining for performance. And, Your Honor, the milestone...
Is that conclusion fact or law?
Your Honor, that is a legal standard, one that this court has applied
The standard, I agree with you, by which the conclusion is reached is a legal standard. But is the bottom line conclusion that I, the contracting officer, or we, DOD, conclude that on the basis of all the information we have, the contractor can't perform in accordance with the contract as modified?
This court has indicated that that question is one that is open for de novo review, that the contracting officer's conclusion on that does not come with any deference to the board or to the court or the reviewing authority, Your Honor. But My point is that this is a legal standard that this court has insisted upon to govern and guide and cabin the imposition of what is in the nature of a forfeiture under default termination. For the government to impose such a forfeiture, it must be cabined by law, by legal principles, both substantive and procedural. Else, my concluding point here is that if this yardstick approach that the government convinced the district court to adopt is the law, then there will be no distinction, really, at least in contracts like this, between a termination for convenience and a termination for default.
Why would that be? You argue in your brief that if the government's position is accepted by the court here, that in any contract, any line item could be used as a basis for default. I don't see how that follows. This Mod 46, P46 revised schedule for the prototype 8 aircraft is hardly any routine little line item in 100 or whatever, 86 I guess were the number of line items. This is a major chunk, and obviously you can't get to the production phase unless you can perfect the aircraft through the 8 sequential prototypes. So I don't quite see the interiorum argument that if we allow the government to get away with it here, then any contractor in any case who's ever behind on any minute line item is in danger of a default. I just don't see how that follows.
Well, Your Honor, it is certainly true that this was a significant part of this contract, but it was, after all, only one line item in the 87 line items of the whole work of this contract. One line item. And why would it be different from the concern that this court rejected last time we were here, that a failure to meet first flight, which also is a threshold without which nothing after it can take place because it is a threshold in the sequence.
Well, counsel, didn't the original contract require the 8 prototypes to be developed? The 8th one would have to be the one that would then be the subject of what you would get for the lot. But the original contract didn't actually exercise an option for a lot. It only allowed for the government to exercise an option that they then did exercise and said, yes, even though we haven't even seen first flight yet, we'll take a lot of these things.
Yes.
Can't understand why they did that part, but they did. And so the original contract as written only anticipated and was concrete with regard to 8 prototypes.
Actually, Your Honor, I want to push back on that. The original contract as written, yes, had 58 or 56 line items that dealt with the prototypes, and the 8th one was the one that they contemplated would be the principal plane for the years of testing that would take place after.
The original contract didn't actually commit the government to buying a lot.
But it did contemplate, Your Honor, that
it didn't commit them.
Well, it didn't commit them.
No,
but
they had
to
exercise that option.
But it made no sense unless they did, because they
that's nonsense. The government all the time funds research and development without committing to a concrete purchase order of 50,000 of these things. From your standpoint, it makes no sense because you're not going to spend all this money, you personally, meaning the companies you represent, developing these planes, but for the expectation that then you'll be able to reap some reward by selling these planes, and the government is your only likely consumer.
But lot one, the only one they exercised, was for 6 planes, 4 of which the contract specifically contemplated would be used in the testing, the years of testing under the first 58 CLINs.
But the government didn't have to exercise that option. They didn't have to purchase 6 planes from you. They didn't have to undergo future testing on those 6 planes with you. None of that was required by the contract.
Your Honor.
Correct? Yes or no? Yes or no?
Yes, but it made no sense, Your Honor.
It made no fiscal business sense from your standpoint to enter a contract if that was your endpoint. But you anticipated, as being able to satisfy the government with regard to the creation of these planes and then anticipated the future purchase of lots of planes, and that was part of your incentive behind signing it. But the contract didn't require anything more than the
Well, Lot 1 was an integral part of the testing program. If the government was going to exercise it, they had
to
exercise
it. Suppose, counsel, that we were here and, in fact, the government, when they did P-46, in fact, gave a date for Lot 1, which they clearly didn't do, but suppose they had. Wouldn't you be here today? It seems to me your entire argument is premised on the open-endedness of when Lot 1 could be delivered and how that, from a strict standpoint, makes application of Lisbon difficult, if not impossible, and that's why we're here.
Actually, no, I don't think I would be here, because I think that under Lisbon and under DeVito and this court's other precedents, it's clear that if the government had put in place a unilateral schedule, not just for the first eight prototypes, but for the Lot 1 production planes as well, that schedule would have had to have been reasonable given the performance capacities of the contractors at the time the new schedule was unilaterally imposed. And that would mean, obviously, that
Well, you all didn't debate the reasonableness of the unilateral new schedule that was imposed, right? That's not something that has been subject to suit or that we're here to decide.
Oh, no. Well, this court has concluded that it was reasonable,
right. Okay.
That it was enforceable.
So, originally, there was originally a date in mind for Lot 1, correct? Some point in the past, there was a date in mind for Lot 1.
Yes, in fact, the first four, the test planes of Lot 1.
Just tell me how many days it was from in the original contract from when number 8 came out until Lot 1 was due.
In the original contract?
At any point in time when there existed dates, how much time did you have to give them Lot 1? From when 8 was done and they accepted 8 to when Lot 1 would be due.
Your Honor, I think it was a matter of months. After the 8th plane until the first Lot 1 plane was due under the original contract.
Right. So if in this particular case there were a number of months after whatever P-46, I don't remember the exact days, whatever date P-46 assigned for prototype number 8 to come, if a matter of months later, or even suppose they doubled the time, suppose it was originally 3 months and they gave you 6 months, so after 8, 6 months later, Lot 1 will be due, would we be here? Is this... I guess what I'm worried about is this all devolves down into the government didn't specify when Lot 1 was due, therefore, ha, we win. And that troubles me.
Well, Your Honor...
If you have a crisp answer to that, deliver it, but we're going to have to move on to Mr. Verrilli. We've given you 9.5 minutes of extra time over your expanded...
I probably get to ask him the same question, right? So...
You do, what I would say, Your Honor, is that it is clear that in order to terminate for default, for failure to make progress, the analysis, if we were back here at the time, would be, could the contractors reasonably be expected to complete the entire contract effort? You don't judge default for failure to make progress based upon an interim milestone, even if that milestone is one of the four production lots to be used in the testing.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Verrilli. Now, the ground rule will have to be don't repeat anything already said. Anything that's unique to your client, you're certainly entitled to emphasize. Anything else you have to say that's relevant, we'll hear, but we don't want to go over any of the ground that's already been plowed.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Chief Judge Michel, and may it please the Court. I would like to return to Judge Moore's question and add a different and, I hope, clarifying point, which is critical. Remember, this is a research and development contract, and the end item is not a plane or a series of planes. It is a fully validated and tested design that can then be used for mass-scale production later. The critical point that's been missing from the discussion so far, I think, Judge Moore, is that it's not just about Lot 1. In fact, the testing phase for the 8 prototypes, as well as, Mr. Cooper said, for the 4 of the 6 Lot 1 aircraft, was a phase that was scheduled under the original contract to run for some 39 months after the conclusion of the, after the delivery of the eighth prototype. This was not.
Wait, what was to run for 39 months? The testing of lot one.
No, the testing of the prototypes, and the testing of four of the six lot one aircraft. Because the goal was to take those prototypes and use different prototypes to test different features of the aircraft's performance and design, modify it along the way, keep changing the design over time, until at the end of that process, there was a fully validated and tested design which the Navy would accept. That was the end item of the contract. And the problem here, and I think I also want to try to address Chief Judge Michel's concern about the Lisbon test and how it ought to apply here, is that given that that's the end item.
What's the end item again?
The end item is a fully validated and tested design.
Does the contract suggest that?
That's what the contract says, and I believe the government will agree that that's the end item of the contract.
So what would the date on that have been?
Well, the original contract went through CLIN 58, and CLIN 58 had a date of, I believe it was 1996, a date in 1996. Now, CLIN 58, the government had flexibility under this contract, despite CLIN 58, to continue to require performance on our part, but the point here is that
how long did the original contract provide from when the contract was entered until what you conceive of as the end date? How many months, years, days, whatever would have transpired?
That's difficult to say, but it's at least 7 years, and that's the key point here.
How much time actually did expire before the government terminated for default?
About two or three. So, that seems to me to be the key point here. Now, and I want to try to address Chief Judge Michel's question, if I might, at the same time as answering your question.
So, in four more years, you believe you had four more years to
catch up.
Had there been a reasonable schedule reimposed by the government for the testing and the Lot 1 phase, then one could conduct an inquiry into whether it was reasonable for...
The government imposed a reasonable schedule with regard to the eight prototypes.
Right.
That's already been determined, and it's not performing.
That's correct.
So,
but at that point, it necessarily disestablished the original schedule for Lot 1 and the testing, because that was sequentially keyed off of the original prototype dates. And once those were gone, the other dates were gone. And just as true as a matter of law, it's what the board cases say. The problem we face here is that the government had the unilateral power to set a new schedule for those 39 months of testing, to set a new schedule for the delivery of Lot 1. Had they done so, then of course the contractor's performance could be evaluated on the basis of whether we would have made the time, whether we would or wouldn't have been expected to make the time up.
Do you consider that there is no remaining dispute about whether the aircraft would meet all the operational requirements, weight, and all the rest?
Yes, Your Honor. There was a trial on that issue. There were factual findings by Judge Hodges, which the government has never challenged as clearly erroneous.
So in your view, this is only about time?
It is, and I think that's a critical point. It's an absolutely critical point here that I understand Your Honor's point about thinking about this in harmless error terms, but with all due respect, I don't think that's reasonable here for the following reason. The government initially tried to frame this as a case like the Universal Fiberglass case, in which the contractors were in meltdown, couldn't meet technical specifications, couldn't meet weight, didn't have the money to do it, repudiated, didn't give adequate assurances. That case was tried in 2001, and the government lost on every single one of those issues, and they have not said that any of the factual findings supporting those conclusions by Judge Hodges are clearly erroneous. Therefore, the only thing left
in the most recent case, though, that's being appealed to us on remand, certainly Judge Hodges went through the various statements that were made, and on page 58 of the appendix, he says, the contractor's admissions of inability to complete the work according to P46 schedule allege impossibility of satisfying design requirements and concerns about business issues do not alone satisfy the government's obligation to prove default. But then I understood him to weave them in nonetheless in discussion throughout the opinion about why it was reasonable for the government to assume that you weren't able to comply. Those statements were part, I thought, of his decision. Am I wrong about that? I mean, did he just disregard them entirely? Said, nope, I already decided these don't matter. They're irrelevant to the decision I'm making in the most recent case
that's
being appealed
that
to.
That is a correct description, Your Honor, of the judge's decision, but with all due respect, it leaves out something critical, which
tell
is
me.
That What Judge Hodges specifically said he was doing, and I believe that this is at page 54 of his opinion, but forgive me if I'm wrong, he says he's conducting an evaluation of the question of whether the contractors would be behind schedule with respect to PU 46, comma, not the contract as a whole. And then later on, he says, this evaluation, taking into account those factors, is a measure of whether the contractors would be able to meet the PU 46 schedule.
Is there any reason to think he wouldn't similarly take them in, even under your desire to have him look at a 7-year time frame? Is there any reason to think that these wouldn't be relevant considerations to him? That, you know, when your CEO is saying we can't do it without a public law basically bailing us out, we've heard that word quite a bit lately, but, you know, I don't see how that statement would be treated by this judge any differently regardless of the endpoint of the contract.
I do think there are 3 points to make in response to that. They're all, I think, quite important. First, I think the answer is yes, Judge Hodges would and did treat them differently. He made a finding in 2001 that the very statements to which Your Honor is referring did not constitute a failure to give adequate assurances because, understood in context, they were merely hard bargaining in the course of a negotiation on the first day of a negotiation that lasted 4 days, and that the government kept negotiating. They didn't understand it as an expression of
willingness. I understood those findings to be a statement that these statements alone don't constitute the basis for default. But I really understood what him to do throughout the entire life of this very long case was to continue nonetheless to consider them as part of more of a totality of the circumstances approach with regard to the default.
That seems to me to get to the second important point, which is that the problem, I don't think that that's what Judge Hodges, I'm quite confident reading the opinion, that's not what Judge Hodges did. And the problem here is that it seems to me the very point of the Lisbon test is to say that it is impermissible to assume, by virtue of the fact that a contractor is behind schedule on a series of interim milestones, that the contractor will not be able to complete the ultimate end item of the contract within the time remaining for performance. The government has to prove that and prove it, moreover, with tangible direct evidence. And I think, Judge Moore, the problem with that line of reasoning is that there is nothing left but an assumption that by virtue of the fact that we were behind schedule with respect to PU 46, that we would inevitably have not delivered the contract's end item within the time remaining for performance. And the problem there, of course, is that having disestablished the original contract dates, there is not a basis on which the government could reasonably conclude that we wouldn't deliver the ultimate end item within the time remaining for performance because there's nothing to measure it against. And that's what's so unfair about this situation. And it seems to me it's particularly unfair in that this is an item that's entirely within the control of the government. They can set a unilateral schedule. In fact, they had tentatively drafted a unilateral schedule for the rest of contract performance. They just never implemented it.
One of the things that just troubles me about the way that you're arguing this is that you want this 7-year period of time, but I imagine there's agreement that 39 months of that 7 years was devoted to testing what had to be completed lot planes. So you can take that 39 months off your 7 years. That's not extra time that you get to spend building the prototype or achieving first flight or anything else.
That's the key question, Judge Moore, is whether there was compressibility in that time. Whether
it's not compressibility. I don't understand there to be any compression. I understand that the contract allowed for 39 months for testing.
And the question is whether the contractors could have completed the required testing in sufficiently fewer than 39 months that they would no longer be behind schedule. In order for the government, even in this hypothetical world in which there was a contract completion schedule, which there isn't.
Well, then explain to me more about the testing, because maybe I don't understand. I thought the testing was not something completely at the disposal of the contractors, but something to which the government was very much involved in.
Which means
that I'm a little nervous about your statement that you would have been free to compress the testing somehow.
Well, but
The contract allowed for 39 months. It didn't give you the option of altering that time
frame.
Well,
if we could have, nothing precluded us from doing it faster than 39 months. And a large majority of that time is in the control of the contractors. It's contractor testing, followed by the tech eval test phase, followed by the op eval test phase, and then the BIS trial test phase, which are test phases in which the government is intimately involved. But there is a very long period of time in which we are testing these planes. And the point here is that there is the government.
Seems like that would be something you wouldn't want to rush.
Well, we would want to do what we could to comply with whatever reasonable schedule was in place. But it seems to me quite clear that it cannot impose this potentially multi-billion dollar sanction of default termination on the basis of a guess as to whether or not we could have caught up on the basis of some hypothetical schedule that the government could have but never did in fact impose. And I do think that, you know, I think for an important point of reference just to see why it would be really an unjust result as well as one that's not in accord with the law or any reasonable application of the court's mandate is to compare two schedules. One is the schedule for contract completion that Captain Elverfeld had in mind, which you can find in the Joint Appendix at 26037, and the contractor's final projections for when they thought they would complete the full range of testing of the aircraft, and that you can find in the Joint Appendix at 92113, and you'll see they line up almost exactly month for month as to when this would have gotten done. And that's the problem here. The government had that power to exercise unilaterally to impose a reasonable schedule for contract completion, and given that the only thing left to the government to justify this default termination is schedule, that we were behind schedule, it can't be right that they can default us on the when they haven't got a schedule against which they can measure that performance.
All right, let's hear from the government. Mr. Snay, good morning, welcome. Please proceed. We'll give you some extra time for purposes of parity since we've given the other side extra time.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, the decision of the trial court should be affirmed because the record here, which includes, among other things, the contractor's admissions that they could not successfully perform this contract without a new and different contract, satisfies any rational application of either the duty to make progress or the duty to provide adequate assurances when required. There are three points we would like to address today. First, the trial court correctly found that the contractors were in breach of their duty to make progress. Secondly, that the trial court correctly found that the government did not waive any of its default rights under the contract. And finally, as an alternative to the trial court's holding, the record establishes as a matter of law that the contractors failed to provide adequate assurances when requested.
Can I get you to answer
ma'am?
The law of the case question
yes,
Judge Michelle had raised earlier about what constrictions a later panel has upon it in light of a remand order from an earlier panel that may have asked the district court to do something that was impossible in a particular case. What happens?
Before I reach my three points, I wanted to address three things raised by my opposing counsel's argument. That was the first of them. The answer to the question is yes, if this court felt it was necessary to revise the statement of the mandate provided by the prior consideration of this court in 2003, this court may do so. And that this court may do so because, as this court recognized itself in the 2003 decision, that questions of law are, of course, reviewed de novo, and this includes the plenary review of our own mandate. And that statement is provided in the very first paragraph in the 2003 opinion at page 10,012. One, we review issues of law de novo without deference to the trial court, skipping the citation. This plenary review also applies to interpretations of our own mandate, citing Engel Industries Incorporated versus Lockheed.
Yeah, but the question isn't whether we can interpret what our mandate meant. The question is whether we can effectively revise it, change it.
Correct, Your Honor. And I believe, however, that even though there were, it would be less than honest if I did not say that there were certain sentences in the 2003 opinion which gave the trial judge pause. In fact, a considerable amount of the time on remand was spent not arguing about the record of the contractor's performance or non-performance, but was spent arguing about the interpretation of the 2003 decision. But what the trial court did and how the trial court interpreted and applied that decision was fully consistent with the direction in that decision as well as existing and controlling precedent. And that's why the first point we would turn to address is that, in fact, the trial court correctly applied and faithfully followed the mandate as given. Before reaching that, however, I'd like to address two other questions that came up during the questioning of my opposing counsel. And the first is with respect to the suggestion raised by both Mr. Cooper and Mr. Varelli that the admissions that the contractors made relating to their inability to perform the contract without a restructure relates only to the government's argument that they failed to provide adequate assurances. That is not the case. And the trial judge expressly relied upon the contractor's admission that they could not perform the contract in accordance with its terms as part of its failure to make progress analysis. And let's be clear about how explicit the contractors were. Following the issuance of a cure notice, the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition, Mr. Yockey, sat across the table from the chief executive officers of the two corporations and asked them, can you do this fixed price contract for whatever it takes? And the contractor's response was, we cannot do it, it must be reformed to a cost-type contract. And the trial judge relied upon those analyses, even though he ruled that the government's alternative argument of adequate assurances was not justified, and we'd be happy to address that in a minute. He relied upon that analysis to sustain one as one of the factors which sustained his failure to make progress analysis. And I would specifically refer the court to, I won't read all of it, but starting at about page 56 of the slip opinion, or at about page 422 of the Westlaw version, the trial judge begins to list all of the relevant facts and testimony that he relied upon to demonstrate that the government met its burden of showing the reasonableness of a belief that the contractors would not timely perform the entire contract.
We're not, or could not, in the remaining time, whatever that is.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
We're not performing or could not perform in the future fast enough to meet the ultimate deadline, whatever it is.
The contractor's admissions were explicit that they could not perform the contract without a restructure at all. They never suggested they could perform the contract late. They never suggested they could catch up at some point in performance. They said directly, both orally and in written response to the cure notice, that we cannot perform this contract.
Well, if that's true, they were repudiating the contract, but I thought we had a finding that they didn't repudiate the contract.
It is true that the trial judge rejected the government's alternative argument related to adequate assurances. However, the trial judge erred in that regard, and as an alternative basis to the failure to make progress analysis, which he did adopt and which we do embrace, the court could, in the alternative, sustain on that basis alone. As in Danzig versus...
Isn't the failure to make progress, in the context of this case, all about future steps? Not about past deadlines that were missed, but about whether future deadlines would be met.
With respect, Your Honor, it relates to both. The failure to make progress in Judge Hodges' analysis relies first upon the contractor's admitted inability to accomplish the work that was required under the unilateral schedule. We call it PU 46. That schedule covered the next 2 years of performance. That is the work the contractors were trying to do. That is where all attention was focused. To put it colloquially, all of the contractor's eggs were in the basket of that unilateral schedule. And the contractors admitted that they were unable to accomplish any of the 8 delivery dates required by that contract. It may be a single line item, as Mr. Cooper said, but in fact, in Section F of the contract, the delivery schedule, each of those 8 aircraft had a specific delivery date upon which it was due. The trial judge accepted that those delivery dates were material terms of the contract. Material meaning...
Do you agree that the planes that might have been provided for each of the required deliveries, although late, would have met the other requirements, the operational type requirements?
That remained to be determined once an airplane could be built and all of them could be tested. The trial judge did imply, I would say, in his findings.
No, but at the time of termination, was it the view of the government that these are going to be late, but okay, or that they're going to be late and not okay?
I think the fairest characterization of the view of the government was that they would be at best late if they could be delivered at all. and I'm not trying to fence here, they all parties understood that time equals money. And when the contractors were expending $100 or $150 million a month to say that somebody is going to be two or more years late in performance, which is what the trial judge found they admitted, suggests very strongly, as the government officials with the program believe, is that they would never ultimately receive those airplanes without a bailout.
Because what? The two contractors would go bankrupt and stop doing any work on making airplanes?
The government never attempted to show that the two contractors would go bankrupt, although Judge
Hodges... Well, then what is it as a practical matter, just as a common sense matter, would have prevented them from building the rest of the aircraft that were owed?
As a practical matter, what the government officials observed is that because of the contractors' considerable concerns about the cash flow problems they were facing, instead of doing the type of work that one would need to do to accelerate performance, additional work, workarounds, do the kinds of things that you would need to do to solve technical problems, the contractors, in fact, were not doing that. In fact, were reducing overtime and taking steps to constrain costs. And Judge Hodges cited with approval the testimony of Ms. Spector, the Chief of Defense Procurement, the testimony of Captain Eberfeld, the Chief Program Manager for the government, and the testimony of Admiral Lockhart, the Chief Engineer of the Naval Systems Command, that in their observations, the contractors' cost concerns, in fact, he cited the testimony of Admiral Morris, that the contractors' cost concerns were leading them to expend less effort at the very, very time.
Yeah, but how does that prove that they couldn't speed up in a later phase?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, it's not the government's burden to prove that they couldn't catch up. It's the government's burden merely to prove by a preponderance of the evidence the reasonableness of a belief that they were not timely performing.
Well, we're aware of that.
Okay? And Judge Hodges' finding, first with respect to Proof 46, is 2 years of performance, 8 material delivery dates, none of which are going to be met, in and of itself, no matter what establishes, they're not going to perform the entire contract.
I still don't understand really quite what you're saying. Are you saying that because of cost cutting or bankruptcy or something else related primarily to cash flow, they would never be able to produce all the required airplanes? Or are you saying, well, we don't know whether they could have or they couldn't have, but at the very least, they would have all been quite late, even under the relaxed delivery date of 46.
The government, it is clear, and Judge Hodges cites, for example, the testimony of Admiral Cook, who expressed his opinion that in the absence of a bailout, the government would not get anything of value. For the purposes of simply establishing a failure to make progress, the fact that the contractors were cutting back on costs instead of accelerating work, those findings of facts which the trial judge made supports the reasonableness of a belief. It's not the government's burden to prove that it was impossible for the contractors to perform. We merely have to show the reasonableness of a belief that if you were standing there in 1990, would you think it reasonable that the contractors would timely perform everything? And here's what Judge Hodges looked at. He looked at, okay, I know the unilateral schedule is enforceable, and I know they're not going to meet that. I also am going to look at their admissions. They are telling the government that they cannot perform in the absence of a restructure. They're also telling the government that they will be 2 or more years late, assuming they could in fact fly by March 1992. He relied upon, in addition to the contractor's admissions, he relied expressly upon the testimony of Admiral Morris, the contracting officer. And specifically, and now we're in the section of his decision where he is talking about the failure to make progress, he refers to, and I am on page 58 of the slip opinion, he cites to the termination notice which Admiral Morris sent the contractor, and then says this: testimony by Morris at trial supports these conclusions, i.e. that they were failing to make progress.
Is it appropriate to use the PU 46 subset to determine default of the whole?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
But why? Because isn't it the government's failure to give a completion date for the whole that we're saying, because you're not making the first part, it's not logical that you're going to make any part of the last part? Can you explain that?
Yes, I have two answers to that, Your Honor. First of all, the trial court did correctly interpret that there was nothing in the 2003 decision or controlling precedent which made the existence of a completion date an absolute prerequisite to the application of the contract's failure to make progress provisions. This court's decision in Universal Fiberglass, which was cited with approval twice in the 2003 opinion, sustained a failure to make progress in the absence of any schedule whatsoever.
Yeah, but that company was doing virtually nothing. They just shut down. That's not the case that we have here.
The case was cited, with due respect, sir, in the 2003 opinion for the very proposition that failure to make progress is not abandonment, that it is something different than abandonment.
Is it not the case that that company basically stopped doing any of the work?
There are certain facts in that case which are different than the ones here, obviously. And it is true that in that case, the financial problems there led the contractor to, in fact, lay off almost all of its workforce, and that's not the case here. Other factors which this court relied upon was the fact that the contractors had missed all of its preceding deadlines, all the other deadlines. That is true here. The nature of the cost concerns these contractors were experiencing may not have been as dramatic, but they nevertheless were adversely affecting.
Was that a development contract? I forget.
It actually is not characterized as such, but technically it is, because it was for the development of a new mail cart. Now, admittedly, a mail truck is not an airplane, so it's a technical problem.
I think you're stretching to the breaking point to try to rely much on that case. It looked to me like the facts are so different that it's not of much help to you.
Here's what, even acknowledging all those factual differences, Your Honor, here is the one help it does have. The contractor's position is that a contract completion date is an absolute prerequisite, is categorical. That is, their position is, and they stepped around it earlier today, is their position is, in the absence of a contract completion date, they are entitled to judgment as a matter of law.
Even if that's one of their positions, put it aside. What about what I clearly understand them to be arguing the other position to be, which is it's at least got to be the 7 years. It's got to be the whole time. It's clear to me that the trial court didn't make a determination that I can affirm without reaching fact findings of my own, which I would never do, on whether or not they were capable of completing within 7 years. We said, don't use the ruler, so he pulled out the yardstick. Mm-hmm. You know, but he was supposed to use the football field.
To try to answer your question specifically with respect to, I think there are a couple of additional facts that may, or not facts, but contract terms that may help us address that. The questions you were having with Mr. Varelli related to the notion of what was the date that the contract provided for the fully validated design? This goal of the contract to have a fully validated design that the government, the Navy, could take to DOD to get approval for production. What was that date? That date was April 1993. And it is spelled out in contract line item number 56, which was the completion of all testing by the Navy. It's called tech evaluation. And at that point in time, the contractors were supposed to have designed all 8 airplanes, manufactured, and tested all 8 airplanes.
Yeah, but it seems to me that if we were to abide by the existing schedule, which I know you would very much like us to do in the contract, which would seem to me to be somewhat nonsensical because the prototype was actually then effectively due after the lot. How can that be the case?
I understand the argument that the two are nonsensical. I'm just trying to answer first, if I could, the factual question of how much time was intended for the testing to be accomplished. The testing was supposed to be accomplished in the period of time of 5 years and 3 months between all work was supposed to be done.
Okay, forget about all this.
Okay.
Here's my question. If we disagree with the yardstick, I would imagine, have to vacate and remand because I can't imagine how we have adequate factual findings or otherwise in this record to reach the issue of was there a reasonable belief that they couldn't have done this in the whatever the endpoint is time. I mean, we don't have to haggle over whether it's 7 years or 5 years or 9 years because we know that whatever endpoint it should have been isn't what this trial court looked at in this opinion, and that's the only thing in front of me. So isn't it the case that I have to, under those circumstances, if I believe that I cannot accept the yardstick he articulated, vacate and remand?
No, Your Honor. Number one, this case is now approaching its 18th year of litigation. It has lasted 6 times longer than the contract date.
That's an appalling fact, but how does it change the legal analysis we have to perform?
Because the legal analysis which the trial judge performed, which did not rely upon a contract completion date, fully complies with the 2003 directions as well as existing precedent. He took the unilateral schedule, which covers a two-year period of performance and encompasses eight material dates of delivery. He made two conclusions from that. One, that the contractors admitted they were incapable of delivering in accordance with that schedule. Thus, they were in material breach of terms of the contract. Whatever else may be said.
But didn't the original contract include dates for ship delivery of a lot and also include dates for completion of testing of both the original 8 and the lot? So the original contract, didn't it have dates for all of this?
Yes, it did, Your Honor. And by unilaterally extending a portion of them, understand very clearly why the government extended those dates in the unilateral manner that it did. And Judge Hodges made specific findings with respect to this. And that is, in the face of the contractor's breach and their failure to deliver in June of 90, and their refusal to agree to a bilateral modification, the government issued a unilateral modification to preserve, to take the contractors out of default, to give them something to perform to. For what purpose? While it evaluated whether it should or should not terminate the contract or whether it should restructure. And Judge Hodges made very explicit findings with respect to that the contractors understood that was the purpose of POO 46. So today, in litigation, they can claim, well, it's illogical or nonsensical. But everyone understood, as of June 1990, that they were not going to be able to meet the Lot 1 dates because in June 1990, their CEOs came in and announced that we are 12 to 14 months behind in delivery of the first aircraft, and necessarily, we are 12 to 14 months behind in delivery of everything under the contract.
I have to say, if the trial court had made all of the findings that you're suggesting that he has, and you certainly, I'm sure, have lived with this record and know it better than I do, but if he did, then why in the world didn't he just say the end date was the end date of the 39 months and measure that? I mean, if he was so stuck to the notion that all P46 did was alter the dates for the eight prototypes but did not change the commitment that Lot 1 was now magically due before the prototypes or the testing period would actually take place before the prototypes were even done, if those numbers had somehow not been determined to be in need of change or having been changed, why wouldn't he have just written opinion saying the end date was whatever date it was under the original contract, no way they could have complied in light of this, end of story?
He specifically addressed that point, Your Honor, and he said that I could rely upon the June 1996 date as the completion date. And to be clear, June 1996 was the very final thing that anything was to be done under this contract. It did not relate to testing.
I know, but he didn't think that was appropriate.
He said, I don't think that's appropriate. It would be inequitable. I don't think it's appropriate because it's not the work the contractors were performing to. So I'm going to use instead the schedule of the work they were performing to, which was the unilateral schedule. But he said because they understood the circumstances under which it was issued, the government did not waive its right to its default rights, even though it didn't give them a completion date. It reserved its rights for default even in the absence of a completion date because the contractors understood that they could be terminated for default, notwithstanding the fact that the government had given them a unilateral schedule.
So you're suggesting that the trial court found that the contractors were still bound by the ultimate completion date in this case?
No, he expressly rejected.
That's what I thought. That's why I'm not understanding what you're telling me.
Why didn't he just extend the Lot 1 aircraft due dates by the same interval they had under the original contract?
I'm not sure why he didn't do that, Your Honor, but the government...
Rule that that's what he should have done, and because he didn't do it, he got to do it on a further remand.
Because the court correctly recognized that when the government issued the unilateral modification, that unilateral modification also made clear that all other terms and conditions of the contract remain in place, which would include the other delivery dates. And the reason the government was doing that was to reserve its default rights for the contractor's admitted breach, which started at least as early as June 1990, when they admitted they could not perform any portion of the contract at least for 12 to 14 months on time. So what Judge Hodges found is that the government's issuance of POO 46 was an exercise in preserving its contract rights, not destroying them. And that is the basis that he understood that.
Is that in his opinion?
Yes, ma'am, it is. In Judge Hodges, I have a shorter version right here. The particular discussion with respect to, it's where he rejects the contractor's waiver defense, which can be found, Your Honor, starting principally on page 69 of the slip opinion, and a waiver of delivery schedule. And I would refer you to specifically the top of page 70. A waiver is generally considered an intentional relinquishment of a legal right. A finding under DeVito that the Navy waived its right to terminate for default in this case would assume irrational behavior on the Navy's part. Then he skips, I'll skip a bit, and he ends with pointing out the language in the unilateral modification. Having stated new dates for 8 aircraft, the modification stated, all other terms and conditions of the contract remain the same. And on the subject of waiver,
but we all agree that that's nonsensical, that to talk about a due date for a Lot 1 production aircraft before the prototype has been built is just ridiculous. It obviously can't happen. You can make an argument that, well, yeah, but they never changed the due dates of Lot 1, but we all know that they would have to change the due dates of Lot 1 because the original dates were completely impossible and therefore not enforceable dates.
The problem with that construct, and the reason I do not accept the contractor's construct, is that it's a very carefully constructed construct which assumes away the issue. Their construct is, well, you can't have it both ways going. One schedule can't be enforceable if it conflicts with the other schedule. Those two things don't make sense. And in fact, the government witness testified that nobody expected us to deliver in accordance with the original schedule. I understand that. I understand those facts, and I accept them absolutely. The fallacy in that construct is they're assuming away the question. If you ask the question neutrally and then look at the record, you might get a different answer. And here's the way I propose you ask that question neutrally. That is, did the government, in issuing the unilateral modification, also effectively reserve its rights to rely upon the contractor's breach of the original schedule as an additional basis to sustain the default?
Well,
and here's, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, no, finish.
And I was going to say, here's why. The answer to that is yes, because we know the dates in the original contract are binding. Why? Because they're bilaterally agreed to. So we know they're binding for that reason. We know the modification didn't change them because it said they remain the same. And we know that the judge found that the government did not waive its default rights. And in the point I was just pointing out to you, Judge Hodges made a specific finding of fact.
You're skipping over the fact, as argued by the other side, that everybody had to understand that even though as a matter of law, perhaps the Lot 1 due dates would remain in force, that they couldn't be met, and that therefore a court would have to view them as unenforceable, as if they didn't exist. Yeah, they're on the piece of paper, but effectively they've been erased because once you do P46, those dates become impossible, become nonsensical, and therefore they have to be assumed to not be enforceable, and therefore they're effectively erased from the document.
Yes, and to be clear, Your Honor, my discussion with respect to the waiver point here, we do have an alternative argument that they weren't waived, and if there is a requirement for a technical completion date, there is one. My point in discussing this is to describe Judge Hodges' use of that. Judge Hodges' use of that is to say, because the contractors knew that the limited purpose for which P46 was being issued, that is to provide a bridge while reserving the government's rights, the fact that when the government issued the unilateral modification, it didn't also include a completion date, that does not amount to a waiver of the government's rights.
I don't understand there to be an argument about waiver. I understand the argument to centrally be that the law, as set forth, for example, in Lisbon, has certain requirements in it, and they weren't met here, period.
And Judge Hodges' analysis.
And that has nothing to do with waiver or the intention of the government or what the contractors understood or who expected what would happen next. It's just a question of if the law requires something and it isn't provided, then there's a problem.
The relevance of the waiver argument, at least as I understood it from the contractor's position, was that because the unilateral schedule didn't set a completion date, the government no longer had the right to terminate for default in the absence of a completion date. And what Judge Hodges found is the government did not waive its termination rights when it set a partial but not complete schedule because the contractors understood the purposes for that partial schedule. But to be clear, Judge Hodges did not rely upon a final completion date, he found that the violation of the partial schedule, plus their admissions, plus the fact they'd missed all prior deadlines, plus the government's agreement that the contractors could not perform without it, plus their remarkable demonstrated inability.
There's lots of evidence here, and Hodges goes through it in detail, and you summarize it. We're aware of all of the facts that show slippage and problems and huge problems and continuing problems and all the rest. But at the end of the day, it seems like the question is whether the prophylactic protection provided by Lisbon has such an important policy purpose that it must be complied with, no matter how bad the conduct of a contractor to date, in order to preserve the circumstance that if they could catch up in future phases, they can't be defaulted now.
Well, 2 points, I guess. First, Your Honor, the contractors here don't have a right of catch-up. There is no right of float, because this contract contained a specified delivery schedule for each of the 57 items in the contract. And so the contractors do not have the right to miss all of those delivery dates, and then on the day before completion, June 1996, deliver all the airplanes, all the testing reports, and everything at once. Rather, these parties specified in Section F of the contract when these pieces of work would be due. And more specifically, I would direct the court's attention to attachment 25 of the contract, the so-called master program schedule, which has an additional clause, which is at least unique in my experience.
I don't understand that you're responding to the question. Maybe the question wasn't well enough framed. There seems to be a policy point of the Lisbon requirement. And your argument that the contractors have missed a million different deadlines and didn't do this and didn't do that may all be correct, but it doesn't necessarily meet the point about what's required by Lisbon.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I understand. I think I get better the gist of your question. And I think the answer to that question lies in the 2003 opinion itself. The contractors argued below, as they've mentioned today, the notion that termination for default is a grievous sanction and should only be sustained upon, should be strictly construed. This court recognized in the 2003 opinion a competing tension in the law, and that is that the government is entitled to full and complete compliance with its contract specifications. And it specifically identified the Lisbon test as the correct balance between those two tensions. And if we turn to the Lisbon test and look at Lisbon contractors itself, what it says is that the burden of proof rests on the government, because it's a government claim. That was a novel ruling, and that is an additional protection that flows to the contractors, because now it's the government's burden. But it says all the government must show is the reasonableness of a belief that they're not going to do it.
We're quite clear on that.
And then it further says the government needs show that only by preponderance of the evidence. That is to say, even though it involves a termination for default, it's not preponderance plus. The contractors don't get a thumb on their side of the scale. It is the same scale. And here, when you look at all of the evidence upon which Judge Hodges relied, and then importantly note, there is no contrary evidence, neither in their brief,
Isn't it true that Judge Hodges closed his eyes to anything happening after the latest P46 date?
No, Your Honor, that's not true. What he found, and I would specifically refer the court to
Maybe I didn't word the question quite so well. My recollection is that he refused to look at what might happen with regard to the sequential aircraft of Lot 1, and focused all of his attention on the 8 prototypes and not on the 6 or so from Lot 1.
I don't believe that's correct, Your Honor. In fact, I would cite the court specifically to page 63 of the slip opinion, where he notes that the building block sequential nature of all of this work, that a delay even in within the first 8 dates necessarily means a delay in all of the downstream dates. When the contractors announced breach in June of 90, they said we're 12 to 14 months late to the first airplane.
We got that. Okay. You said it 4 times. Right. You don't need to say it 5. We've
right.
got it.
Let me say something different for the 5th time, and that is in December, when they were 21 months late for the first flight, they announced they were 27 months late as to completion.
But didn't the prior panel reject that? I mean, wasn't that... I wasn't fortunately on the prior panel, but didn't you come up before several years ago and say, because they're late on one, it's default, and then the prior panel said, no, for the policy reasons in Lisbon,
go back and evaluate the whole and find out if there's a completion date.
I would agree in part, Your Honor. What the prior panel said was, we are not making any decisions about what this contract requires or what the contractor's obligations were because the record before us is incomplete. So go back and you make all of the findings about the law, about the contract, and the performance. I agree with you that this panel said, base your evaluation on the entirety of the record, the totality of the circumstances. But it did not expressly say that one portion of that must be a completion date. In fact, one of the points that Judge Hodges refers to is that the court was given very explicit, gave him very explicit instructions as to how it was to, he was to apply the Lisbon test. And it did not say, if you conclude there's no contract completion date, stop and fold up, you're done. It said, continue and apply it in the full measure. The fact that, to be clear, if there is a contract completion date, and if the government could show mathematically to the highest degree of certainty that they could not perform, yes, that would be the easiest case. But that's not the only way in which the government can prove failure to make progress. And the record here clearly establishes that the contractors were failing to make progress. I'm over my time, but I would ask for just 1 minute indulgence, Your Honor, to address a point that came up earlier, and that is, in the alternative, we believe this record clearly establishes the contractors failed to provide.
Yeah, but that was here before, and we could have affirmed on that basis, and instead we vacated and remanded. So isn't law of the case, isn't that gone now?
No, ma'am, it's not, because Exxon, Supreme Court decision in ExxonMobil holds that law of the case ruling is binding only if it is expressly relied upon by the earlier panel or implicitly, you know, a necessary implication of that holding. Mm-hmm. Because this court vacated and remanded for further findings, the fact that the government strongly urged an alternative holding, as it does now, was not a necessary implication in the remand. And that is what stands in stark contrast to the case the contractors cited in their reply brief of international rectifiers. In that case, this court was affirming a judgment for one party, and the other party was losing, and therefore necessarily the implication was made that alternative arguments were rejected, although not addressed. Here, they were not addressed. The case was sent back for a remand, and this court, under that authority alone, is free to revisit that as an alternative basis to sustain the default. In conclusion, Your Honor, the trial court's judgment should be affirmed either on the basis of the trial court's failure to make progress analysis or on the contractor's failure to provide adequate assurances. In 1999, this court, cited with approval Admiral Morris's description of the choices he faced when choosing to terminate between terminations for convenience and terminations for default. He described, when this court cited, that he rejected the possibility of a termination for convenience because, in his view, it would be unconscionable to place the burden on the taxpayer, given that the default here was entirely that of the contractors. After 17 years of litigation and the contractors having failed to establish that any of the delay was other than their fault, it would be equally unconscionable to place that burden on the taxpayers now.
Can I ask you a question that's not really relevant to our analysis, but it's always puzzled me, I guess as a citizen, why there was so much resistance and ultimately a huge amount of delay in sharing of the government-possessed stealth technology originally developed by the Air Force with the Navy's chosen contractor. As a common sense matter, it looks to me as if had the Air Force technology been handed over at the start of this contract to the two companies, all of this 17 years of litigation would have never happened. And they would have met the dates, and the Navy would have got the plane it needed and wanted, and we'd all be in a much better position. It's just curious to me why one part of the government wouldn't give the other military services technology that was needed to the contractor of the second service.
The legal answer, Your Honor, is that that matter is not before this court and was not before the trial court.
Of course it's not. I agree with all that.
And I point that on because in 2001, the trial court dismissed their superior knowledge claim.